This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss, Cohen in for Terry Gross. A.M. Holmes is a fearless and funny writer with a controversial career. Her first play, written when she was 19, portrayed Holden Caulfield from Catcher in the Rye as a real character that J.D. Salinger meets on a train. Salinger threatened a lawsuit and the story made headlines. Her novel, The End of Alice, gave a somewhat romantic portrayal of a pedophile and was banned by some London bookstores. Her new novel, Music for Torching, is about a married couple, Elaine and Paul, who live with their two sons in an upscale, well-groomed suburb. But several sentences into the novel, and it's clear that there's serious trouble in this family. And by page 20, Elaine and Paul have purposely set their house on fire by kicking over the barbecue grill. A.M. Holmes is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and has written for The New Yorker, Mirabella, Bomb, Blindspot, and Story. She teaches in the writing program at Columbia University and the New School. I asked A.M. Holmes to read from the beginning of her novel, where Elaine and Paul are cleaning up after a party. Elaine is washing the dishes while Paul is straightening up the dining room.
Paul goes into the dining room, this time returning with the wine glasses, the bottle tucked under his arm. Elaine scrapes plates into the trash can. Paul puts the glasses down, brings the bottle to his lips, and finishes it, swishing the last sip round and round before bending over her shoulder and spinning it into the sink, splashing her. "Watch it," she says. "Gristle," he says. "You're doing it on purpose, poisoning me. I could taste the fat going right to the artery." "I should be eating legumes," he says. "I can't make legumes for eight," she says. Elaine loads the dishwasher. "What about her?" she asks. "Who?" "The girlfriend, the date, the woman Henry, who recently left Lucy, whom they all liked a lot, carried around all night like a trophy." "Nice," Paul says, not telling his wife that when he asked the date what she did, as in what her occupation was, she said, "What would you like me to do?" And when he asked, "Where do you live?" she said, "Where would you like me to live?" Paul doesn't tell his wife that before she left, she said, "Give me your phone number," and he willingly jotted it down for her. Paul doesn't tell Elaine that the date promised to call him tomorrow. He goes back into the living room for the dessert plates. "How old do you think she is?" Elaine calls out. Paul returns, his hands filled with wadded-up napkins. He shakes crumbs into the sink. "How old would you like her to be?" 60, Elaine says. She finishes loading the dishwasher, mumbling, "Hope it's fixed, hope it doesn't flood, hope the gasket isn't gone, hope you are right." "Hope so," he says. She adds detergent. "Sink's stopping up," she says. "The house is falling apart. Everything is made of junk." "It only lasts so long," he says, thinking about the date. "How many children do you have?" she had asked him. 2, he'd said. "Isn't that below average? Aren't you supposed to have 2.3, she'd asked. "We need so many things," Elaine says.
And that's A.M. Holmes reading from the very beginning of her brand new book, and it's called Music for Torching. You seem to be saying, I mean, one could argue that you're saying is that marriage is hell. Married people are bored with each other. They're unhappy with each other. One of them, these two characters, are arguing constantly, accusing each other constantly, accusing the other one of ruining their life, and on, a kind of depressing view of marriage, if that's the kind of snapshot you want us to walk away with.
I don't think that's really my snapshot. I think marriage is an incredibly complicated ecosystem. And I think people get married and they bring to it, and Paul and Elaine talk about this, they bring to it enormous hopes of, "I thought you were this kind of person, I thought we would have this kind of life, that together we would do the following things." And I think they've been married for quite a while now. I mean, it's not specified, but right. It's probably at least 15 years. And I think that they're feeling their own failings. They're feeling things that they haven't done for themselves. Elaine hasn't found a place for herself in the world. And I think she's an interesting character in that she's really stuck. And she's like a lot of women who sort of missed feminism, missed post-feminism, still don't really have a job or a career, and don't even know how to begin to reach out. The funny thing about that is when I was writing the book, I actually was at an art colony and Betty Friedan happened to be there. And I said, "Betty, I'm working on this character who's stuck," thinking, you know, Betty would really like get in there and help me. And, you know, help me, not really help me, but talk to me about her and about her stuckness and be interested. Betty couldn't have been less interested in this woman being stuck. She's like, you know, "Tell her to get a job." And I thought, well, that's the problem. Elaine doesn't know she doesn't know how to do anything. She's so trapped, she needs like remedial training for how to figure out even what she would want to do. But Betty didn't care about that.
I'd love to have you actually read another section from the book. And I gave away a little bit in my intros in saying that by page 20, and there's much more that follows here, Elaine and Paul, whom we've just met, set their house on fire. And I'd love to have you read that section for us.
Sure. It's important to say, I think, that they choose to set their house on fire. It's not like an accident. They're outside working with the grill. Elaine pulls back her leg and kicks the grill. The coals fly up and out. The grill tips over. Everything sputters and smokes for a minute, and then slowly the fire builds up from the ground and moves towards the house. They stand watching as fire creeps up the back wall of the house. Wordless, each wonders if it is a game, a dare to see who will run for the garden hose. As the fire builds, their nervousness and excitement grow. Elaine begins to laugh and then stops herself. In the early evening light, the blue flame is nearly invisible. Fire seeps into a crack in the wall. A line of white smoke rises. Elaine watches, wishing she could hurry it, wishing she could be sure. Paul leans on Elaine and puts his shoes back on. "Get the kids and get in the car," he says. Elaine walks away, turning back to see Paul blowing on the fire, fanning it with his hands, encouraging the flame. "We're going out for dinner," Elaine tells Sammy and Daniel. "Roger," they say into their walkie-talkies. They get into the car and wait for Paul. A few minutes later, red-faced, breathless, he joins them. They drive to a nearby restaurant. The waitress fills their water glasses. Paul and Elaine smile at each other. "I'll have the steak," Paul tells the waitress, "and the baked potato with sour cream." "The fat," Elaine starts to say. "I just want to live," Paul says, "live and not worry. Is that possible?" "I'll have the same," Elaine says, closing her menu. During dinner, they hear sirens. They linger over coffee. The children eat ice cream sundaes. When the check is paid, they get back into the car and head home. The street is blocked off, fire engines and police cars. In the distance, they can see their house engulfed, flames shooting out of the roof. In the back seat, the children are oddly silent. "Is that our house?" Daniel asks.
Once again, that's A.M. Holmes reading from her new novel called Music for Torching. This chapter begins with Paul looking in the mirror and cutting most of all of his hair off. And you're right, ruining something, actively destroying it, that he hasn't felt this powerful in years. And this idea of purposely setting your house on fire. And one gets the feeling, at least from this part of the book, that for them, it's the chance at a new beginning, a new start at something.
Yeah, oddly. Yeah, I mean, I think that's really what's happening here, is that oddly, in burning down their house, Paul and Elaine are starting over again. I mean, they're really looking for a way out that's a way back into their lives, but they are so incredibly frustrated and out of their minds, I think, that this is how they do it. They can't find another way. They're really stuck.
But they still can't get out. I mean, even if they resort to something as dramatic as
this.
They
can't get out. I think the other thing that's important, and this is a very pro-marriage thing, is that they are inexorably bound. You can't imagine them separated, which I think is one of the fascinating things about some marriages. I actually love marriage. I think there's a therapist who, I can't remember who it is, who talks about marriage as the natural therapy. And the idea is that you basically bring to a marriage all of the junk from yourself and your life, and you work it out with this other person because you're there together as adults, not even as an adult and a child, and you play it all out.
I'm thinking, too, about the way this house plays such an important role in the novel. And I think most people have overly attached to the places that they live in for all the obvious reasons. I mean, this is the sort of mausoleum you set up to yourself.
Right.
And it makes me wonder whether you have an attachment to place. You talked about growing up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., but do you have a sort of nostalgia for houses you grew up in?
My parents still live actually in the same house we don't move. We don't change, my family. I'm driving an 82 Honda still, just because.
So you do have an attachment.
I have an attachment. I think I'm one of these people who's oddly incredibly sensitive to place. If I'm in a ugly place or in a bad hotel room, I actually have to leave and go elsewhere.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I live in New York in the same place I've lived in since 1985 because it doesn't really occur to me that change is possible. So maybe that's part of it. But my attachments to place are in part aesthetic, in that I have to be someplace where there's light and air and things feel comfortable. And I like to go, you know, to the beach. I like places from my childhood, but I'm not overtly attached.
But have you ever had the sort of impulse of trying to just, I mean, in order to disengage yourself from your life, of just burning it all down or destroying it all?
You know, I haven't. I think I'm one of these people who really feels if I did that, I actually wouldn't know who I was.
Ah, interesting.
So I think that very much actually, in a odd way, my places and objects define me.
I'll talk more with novelist A.M. Holmes after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer A.M. Holmes. Her new novel is Music for Torching. She's written a number of stories with male protagonists. I asked her if she identifies more with male characters than female.
Yeah, I mean, I think my first novel was told from the point of view of a 14-year-old boy. I love boys. I love men. I think they're really, really interesting. And I think the characters that I write from a female point of view, not that they don't interest me as much, but I am female, mm-hmm. and I kind of get that, and I sort of am inside that all day, and I really enjoy being inside another head. And somehow, I mean, I've always liked male characters a lot, and I find them easy to relate to, for lack of a better word. So I spend a lot of time with them, which is sort of unusual, I think.
As a fiction writer, you write what you don't know,
and
you don't... Since you don't inhabit a man's body, you don't know.
I don't know, but I ask them a lot of questions.
Yeah.
And I think the characters that I've written that are female that are close to my age, I have to say, have interested me the least. And I think it's in part because, on the one hand, you know it and you have some perspective on it. On the other hand, to render it in a way that's interesting, that's sophisticated, that gets inside of it and sort of turns it inside out is not so easy to do. And it doesn't interest me because I am so close to all of that. So I really like things that are different. I mean, for me, the most intense book so far was The End of Alice. And it was really from the point of view of a crazy person who is male, who's very, very different from me. But both artistically and intellectually, it was the biggest challenge. And I think Elaine and Paul, being inside a marriage that's 15 years old, I've not been married for 15 years. That interested me a lot, and sort of exploring that. I think the other thing about marriage that I'm into these days is people talk a lot about it as, for a while, everyone was getting divorced, and now the big move is to stay together. So I'm sort of watching all that very carefully and seeing how people do it.
This book that you've written, and I don't want to give too much away in our discussion, but certainly does have its denouement in a school where there's violence. I mean, very much what happened in Littleton. And there's so much talk these days about our violent culture and what causes children to do this and what are some of the images that they carry around that would inspire them to turn on their own friends. And I wonder, as a writer, of someone who, you know, plays with some violent imagery and certainly describing a family here where there's a lot of dysfunction, whether writers have that same responsibility as TV producers and movie makers to be responsible for the kind of languages and images that they create.
I think it's actually a really, really interesting question, and I would say I have a couple different answers. One is that in talking about Music for Torching, a lot of references on a literary level to work of John Cheever and different people have come up, and especially Cheever's work from the 1960s and stuff, which of course I'm very well aware of and influenced by. I also went back and looked at the music of that period. So you look at music of Buddy Holly, the Everly Brothers, and look at the progression of music from then, when rock and roll was just happening and was thought to be dangerous then, to rock and roll now, you know, Nine Inch Nails and really very intense, violent, extreme music. And I think that we see the progression in film and in music much more so than literature. I think literature is a very antiquarian medium, and it hasn't taken on that stuff in that extreme kind of way in terms of representations. I also think it's important, which is sort of my second answer to the question, it came up a lot during conversations about The End of Alice, because that book is quite extreme.
About a pedophile.
Yeah, about a pedophile. And I think one of the things that was important was to say, if as a society we want the abuse of children to stop, if we want violence to stop, we need to figure out how to talk about it. And I think one of the functions that good literature can have is to provoke those conversations. So I think, well, I'm not doing things in a way to shock people just to titillate them and get them going. I'm doing things to make a point in the sense of making it inescapably clear. I felt if I wrote about a pedophile and then just said, and then something bad happened, people wouldn't know what actually happened. I actually, a long time ago, was standing in a coffee store and overheard people talking about Lolita and saying that the main character in Lolita didn't actually sleep with Lolita. And I kept thinking, how could you think that? He actually says that he did. But it was her sort of lack of wanting to know that that horrible thing had happened. And I thought, you have to make it undeniably clear. And in that way, people will be upset because it is a very upsetting thing.
But I wonder whether using the book Before This, The End of Alice,
sure,
whether, let's say, a pedophile was caught with, you know, mm-hmm, with book in hand saying, well, I identified so strongly with this character that A.M. Holmes had created that this was my inspiration. I'm,
right,
you know, overstating it.
And this is exactly the argument in England. Right. It turned into a front page news story for a week. It was sort of horrible. And I think my response to it is to say, first off, that the guy in The End of Alice is in jail. He's been in jail for 23 years. He's completely suffering. He is mentally ill in a very big way. It doesn't exactly make it sound like a good career choice. Mm-hmm. You know, be a pedophile. It's not like join the army. And that was important to sort of, you know, it's not like a positive representation, but also that people said to me, you know, what would happen if this book was found in somebody's apartment? And my answer is also, what if I made steak knives? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't mm-hmm. think that literature causes people to behave badly. I think people do sometimes behave badly. I think that in terms of kids, which was where we sort of started this part of the discussion, and violence and violent imagery, I think kids are susceptible to violence and violent imagery. Kids are not, for the most part, going into bookstores and buying works of literary fiction and then, you know, playing them out.
Do you wish, though, that literature, as you said, it doesn't sort of, I mean, in a perverse way, inspire people to do terrible things, but do you wish it were more inspirational, more powerful?
That's actually a good question. I mean, I think when you're saying it, literature doesn't inspire people to do terrible things, where my whole career as a writer started was with that play where J.D. Salinger tried to sue me. And what prompted the writing of that play was that the guy who shot John Lennon pulled Catcher in the Rye out of his pocket and stood there reading it, which freaked me out. I was 19 years old or whatever, and I was totally upset by that. And that was an example of literature, to my mind, being used to a bad end, representing something that I'm sure the author didn't intend it to represent, and then being carried forward in the culture as an emblem of something that completely beyond the author's control. I think books do become emblematic. Mm-hmm. Books do have meaning for people, and that's potentially a good thing. You know, certain characters like Holden Caulfield and different people throughout literary history have a lot of power.
That's why they get banned and people argue about them and debate them. And
exactly.
A.M. Holmes' new novel is Music for Torching. This is Fresh Air.